Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday afternoon. Our guest this hour has written recently in regards to the Trayvon Martin killing. Anytime an unarmed child or young adult is killed, we are rightly outraged in our society. It shouldn't matter whether the victim is white, black, Latino, or any other racial or ethnic group. The reality in this country is that far too many young people who are killed are black. And young Trayvon's killing has drawn our attention because he was killed by a man who feared him and may not have even been aware that he feared him because of the color of his skin and the hoodie that he wore. Maya Wiley will be joining us momentarily, founder and president of the Center for Social Inclusion. She is a civil rights attorney and policy advocate and has litigated, lobbied the U.S. Congress, and developed programs to transform structural racism in the United States and also in South Africa. In 2011, she was named as one of the 20 leading black women social activists advocating change. And we saw her on the Chris Hayes shows this week, part of a panel discussion on equal justice under law, and thought she would make a good guest for us. So we are just trying to locate her at this very moment, and then we will embark on our conversation, which should be wide-ranging. We'll be looking at, of course, the issue of race and why race did not find its way into a discussion in the courtroom or among the jurors. I think all of us thought race didn't play a role, the woman known as Juror B37 said about the jury's deliberations during an interview perhaps you saw on CNN on Monday. We never had that discussion. So we will have some of that discussion today. Race and law, our guest says, cannot be cleanly separated. And we'll be looking at the Stand Your Ground law in Florida. Eric Holder has said it's fixing something that was never broken. Listen to a lot of people, African Americans, almost to a person, have said they have these conversations with their sons when they are teenagers about being careful, about being very, very careful. And it's something that you wish that parents didn't have to say to black men and to black adolescents. The Justice Department is considering, of course, looking at this, and Eric Holder was speaking to the NAACP National Convention in Orlando yesterday and talked about the fact that he wanted to get more information here, and also he spoke very personally about the Trayvon Martin case, making him decide that he had a conversation, have to have a conversation with his son about what the Trayvon Martin situation meant for him and how he had to be careful because of the color of his skin. We're going to be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I think we should have a very civil and extremely important and interesting conversation this hour of the show. And the second hour of the program, hold on, I got to get my papers, which were behind me. We have talked a whole lot over the past couple weeks about low-income workers, loss of manufacturing jobs, people working two jobs to try to make ends meet. Today, we decided we would highlight the good, the 2013 best companies in the country for hourly workers. If you work for a wonderful company somewhere in Wisconsin and would like to highlight the good in those companies, we would like very much to hear from you as we talk about that hour two of our program. And we're going to be speaking momentarily with Maya, who has done work in this area for a long, long time, and we do have her now. Maya, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I was struck by your comments on the Chris Hayes show, which is how you came to our attention. I thought that was a very important discussion, and a discussion that was emotional, too. I was interested that when he ran clips of how the charges were first brought and how the case was not receiving just attention from the police department, it went way back and ran clip after clip. And you said you thought that you were able to compose yourself, but when you saw that again, it was unnerving.
Yes, it was very unnerving. I have two children, two girls, and, you know, it's very hard, I think, for parents who have children who themselves and have friends who are vulnerable to the kind of assumptions about who they are and whether they pose a danger, you know, is clear and present for a lot of us. And I've had an outpouring, too, of parents who are white who can completely relate to what it must feel like to be a parent who has to worry about the safety of your child because people might fear your child no matter who they are, what they are, and whether they're not doing anything wrong.
Mm-hmm. I'm also amazed by the number of African-American commenters who have said that they really didn't expect justice here, that it's just another in a long line of decisions that have not gone for African-Americans, and they didn't expect there to be an acquittal. Were you among those people?
I was certainly, you know, it's an interesting question because I kind of wear two hats here. I mean, I am a lawyer by training, so of course, seeing how the evidence was going in, not necessarily what the evidence was, but how it was going in, how it was being presented, I was worried about what the outcome would be. I will say that I thought there was a real possibility of a manslaughter conviction.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't convinced there wouldn't be a conviction. And at the same time, certainly, I think, knowing the research, knowing how often people who are white who shoot people who are black are not convicted, it is perfectly understandable that black Americans say, this is our reality.
Let's talk about the issue of race being brought up or not being brought up in this trial. It was amazing to me to hear that juror who was on CNN earlier this week say that race was just not considered at all. And yet, as you wrote in a piece fairly recently, race had to have been considered because somewhere in his mind, George Zimmerman thought this guy was suspicious, this young 17-year-old, because he was black and he was wearing a hoodie. So there had to have been an element of race, and everybody's sort of bending over backwards saying, oh, race wasn't a part of this, race wasn't a part of this. It had to be, didn't it?
Yes, and I think this goes to our need as a nation to catch up to the social science. Our laws have not kept pace with social science. What academics, particularly in the field of social psychology, have been learning for two decades is that the human brain is mostly operates on a subconscious level. 98% of our brain function is subconscious. When we think about our brains on race, what that has meant is that while we have made tremendous strides on conscious racism, on conscious discrimination, most Americans will say that's wrong, and most Americans do not believe and will work very hard not to be discriminatory and not to behave that way. And those are important strides we've made. The reality of our brains on race, though, is that most of our snap judgments are based on stereotypes, and we're not conscious that we're acting differently from our conscious beliefs. So this is a case in which, so for people, a number of us watch this case saying this is all about race. But that's because we either have the lived experience or we know the codes. We're subject to the stereotyping. We know it when we see it. Many, many people are reacting to it, are saying things that demonstrate it, but they are not conscious that that's what's going on. And we should take a step back to say, remember that the judge told the prosecution that it could not call this racial profiling. So when people say that the system did not work, the fact that the judge was, that the prosecution's case was in part based on George Zimmerman had an irrational, unfounded, unreasonable fear of Trayvon Martin based solely on his appearance as a black youth with a hoodie on, if you can't argue that, if you can't make that point to the jury, it's easy for the jury to say, well, race isn't in this.
Right. Is that part of what you meant, and I'm sure you mean more by this, so please expand, when you said the justice system is not a just system?
Yeah, that's certainly part of it. I mean, we when we talk about subconscious bias, first of all, that subconscious bias happens at every phase of deciding whether a crime has been committed, who committed the crime, what kind of investigation, whether it should be prosecuted, how it should be prosecuted, and how a judge and a jury understands the case. And if you look at this case in particular, you have a situation which, when the police showed up on the scene, they basically believed George Zimmerman. One of the biggest pieces of misinformation I think we're hearing from the defense attorneys right now is that this was a great, you know, the police did everything right. Well, the police did not bag Trayvon Martin's hands. The police did not actually run the proper forensics on the scene to see if there was any blood on the sidewalk. I mean, so all of these claims that George Zimmerman was making weren't really fully tested out with the forensic science. Those are decisions that the police made. My assumption is because they took at face value what they were seeing. I am not accusing them of conscious racism. What I am saying is these are the kinds of judgments we make, and we're not always aware how they are motivated by race.
Mm.
And so there are many, many different points in a system, all the way to the judge saying, you can't talk about race. You can't call this racial profiling. So here's the prosecutor. And remember, it was 45 days before charges were brought. It required people fighting and organizing and demanding a proper look at the case, since you had an unarmed youth, no criminal record, dead in his own neighborhood. That's the kind of experience with the system that makes it not a just system for everyone.
Mm-hmm. It was rather shocking, referring again to all of those clips that were run at the beginning of the show I saw you on, to have the police officer say, we didn't file charges because George Zimmerman said he acted in self-defense. And it's as though, well, okay, that's what he said.
Yep.
That's the truth here. When a young man with no criminal background had just been killed.
In his own neighborhood. And one of the things I say to people who say, well, but it's really not about race, I mean, is how many do we suppose that George Zimmerman knew every white person who entered his neighborhood?
Of course
not. Because what George Zimmerman said is, I followed, you know, Trayvon Martin looks suspicious. I didn't know him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I promise you, it's just not believable that George Zimmerman was following everyone he did not know who entered his neighborhood.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you
please.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, and then when you think about the fact that the defense attorneys put a woman on the stand who is white, who very unfortunately and tragically and wrongly suffered a home invasion where two black men broke into her home and she was home with her child, and that happened in the neighborhood. They're using that as evidence that George Zimmerman was rational in his belief that Trayvon Martin was a criminal. Not that he thought Trayvon Martin was one of those two men. Not that he thought that. Just that black people have been breaking into the neighborhood. That's racial profiling.
Mm-hmm.
So then every black, even though black people live in the neighborhood.
Right. What do you make of all that's happened since the verdict came down? There's been some very interesting reaction all over the country. There have been a lot of demonstrations.
Yeah.
There have been musicians, Stevie Wonder, one of them, who's boycotting
yep.
Florida and other states with Stand Your Ground. Bruce Springsteen did a song for Trayvon Martin that he recorded or that he sang in Ireland yesterday. We have Eric Holder talking about the conversation he had to have with his son and speaking to the NAACP about standing our ground, which is another conversation.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of all of that?
Well, I think that Trayvon Martin's killing is a symbol. It's a tragedy, obviously, for Trayvon Martin and for his family. But it is also a symbol of much larger systemic problems that we have not yet fully recognized and been willing to address in this country. And that's, I think, what you're seeing. I think, you know, this is very similar. And I said this yesterday on MSNBC's The Cycle. this is an Emmett Till moment. Remember Emmett Till?
Yes, I do.
Was the boy who was visiting family in Mississippi and had the temerity to look lustfully at a white woman. And that was this symbolic crossing of the color lines that existed back then, and was brutally murdered for it. One of the reasons Emmett Till, he actually became a torch. You know, he really galvanized the civil rights movement, and in all its multiracialness, meaning it, what it did is it showed, because his mother said, that must be an open casket, and everyone must see what they did to my baby.
Yes.
But because it showed people that there's something going on we did not know, because we ourselves are not in those communities, right? It created white empathy for the black experience. And I think that's something that we're seeing now with Trayvon Martin's tragic killing, is I see it creating a lot of empathy across communities for people who said, I didn't know. I didn't know it was like that. I didn't realize. And giving people who are black in this country, and Latino, by the way, and Native American, because that this kind of profiling happens in other parts, in other communities of color as well, that what it does is it enables people to tell the stories of their experiences. Because for black people in this country, it is a completely, there's nothing surprising about hearing Eric Holder talk about telling his son. There's nothing surprising about having to tell our children every day what they have to do not to scare people.
Mm-hmm.
That they can't actually look at the police in a certain way because it makes them vulnerable to attack. That they can't, you know, that, and this is really important, because one of the conversations I've been hearing that I find incredibly disturbing is normalizing that black people should be telling their kids how they should dress and how they should walk and how they should look. If we're really living in a racially just society, we can wear hoodies because we think it's cute,
right,
and not be in danger of being thought a criminal.
Right.
And this is giving us the opportunity to tell that story and to help folks that fortunately don't have this experience, that it's actually happening. And I think that opportunity is a tremendous one for the country that we have to lean into.
We'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm sure you're prepared for all kinds of calls because
yes.
Who knows? We'll hear what we hear, and we'll welcome them momentarily. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Maya Wiley is our guest this hour, founder and president of the Center for Social Inclusion. She is an attorney, a civil rights attorney, and a policy advocate. She's litigated, lobbied the U.S. Congress, and also developed programs to transform structural racism, not only in America, but also in South Africa. To your phone calls, if our lines are busy, you may want to try our email, talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your phone calls now for Maya Wiley, 800-486-8655 is our number. Dino in Madison, hello.
Hi there. Good afternoon. I just wanted to make a couple of quick points. I mean, this really is a tragic case for everybody involved, and I think we do need to have this discussion. But a couple of things we need to consider is, number one, if Trayvon Martin was racially profiled, I mean, there's no way to really know that, especially if it's subconscious. I mean, Zimmerman never mentioned that. We don't know what was in the man's mind. We'll never know that. What we do know, however, is that Zimmerman is not white. He's a person of color. He identifies as Hispanic. Despite his German name, he identifies as Hispanic. He looks Latino. He looks phenotypically mestizo. And I'm sure because of that, he might have been racially profiled at some point in his youth. So I just wanted to make those quick comments. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Dino. Maya.
I think those are very important comments. So two things about them. One, we do actually have ways of identifying whether someone has subconscious bias. There's actually a very good test called the Implicit Associations Test. You can check it online. I really recommend that all viewers go and do it. Secondly, and he made statements that, frankly, are deeply racially coded. The fact that he made the comments effing thugs and referred to a-holes. In other words, he was putting Trayvon Martin into a category. He called the police 46 times over a six-year period only on black folks looking suspicious. So frankly, there is a pretty – now the jury knew about five of them, not all 46. So I think there's a difference between what we know from George Zimmerman's own statements and actions versus what the jury knew, and we should make that distinction. That's about what evidence came in. But there's certainly plenty of indicators of subconscious bias. The other thing that's important to note is implicit bias is pervasive, and it's, we make a mistake if we think that people of color do not carry implicit bias. They do. In fact, it's pretty clear that the statistic is 42% of black people have implicit bias, have preferences for whites over blacks. So it's not the case that it's a pass on implicit bias to say someone is a person of color. It's not because people of color walk around without implicit bias. It's something that we all carry because it is created by stereotypes that exist in society that are portrayed over and over again that we all see and that we're all exposed to.
Maya, do you know why the jury heard only of about five of those calls and not all 46?
Yeah, I mean, the judge, well, I can't speak for the judge, and I won't. I mean, obviously, the judge is in the position of making decisions about what evidence comes into a trial like this and what stays out. And what judges often do is they have a pretty wide berth in deciding what's relevant to a case and what can be damaging to fairness in a process. And this judge made decisions, I think some quite sound, I think some I don't agree with, about what evidence could and could not come in.
Let's go to Barb in Milwaukee. Hi, Barb.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a side question. I live in Washington Heights. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I am, yes.
Yeah, it's more sort of an upscale neighborhood. In fact, it's Mayor Barrett's neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
The neighbors do pretty much know each other, not by name, but by a title, like the lady that jogs at 6 in the morning or the retired teacher that lives here, that sort of thing.
Right.
It's the kind of neighborhood where people take quite a bit of pride. They may have a 10-year-old car, but they've kept it up, that sort of thing.
Yes.
Now, in the last couple of years, there was a man walking his dog, and he was jumped by three teenagers. The police took care of the situation, but they were African-American, and they were clearly not from the neighborhood. I mean, that was brought out at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Neighbors a street over from myself have had people in their backyards. They're not the same race as the people that own the home. It goes in streaks. This will happen, five or six homes, then it'll stop for a while. They're calling the police, and there's arrests made. There will be a car with a busted bumper and a headlight that will park at one end of a block, then move up maybe four or five houses, and then sit for a while. That sort of behavior.
Okay.
Now, would you consider that knowing your neighborhood and being aware, or would you consider that profiling? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Barb, thank you.
I really appreciate that question because it does show that this is new for all of us, right, to understand it in this way. I think, there's objectively suspicious behavior, and when people are engaging in objectively suspicious behavior, it's not profiling. Per se. I think it's when we assume suspicious behavior based solely on appearance. So Trayvon Martin, remember what happens here. Trayvon Martin walks from his home into a store in his neighborhood, buys an Arizona iced tea and some Skittles for his younger brother, and then starts the walk back home. And this is a community that does have black people living in it. So George Zimmerman identifies Trayvon Martin as suspicious by his appearance, not by his behavior. because he makes the call when Trayvon comes out of the store. So I think that this, and certainly if people see suspicious behavior, they believe suspicious behavior, I'm not suggesting they should not call the police. It's the difference in whether we understand and know each other enough to distinguish between suspicious behavior and appearance that might trigger stereotypes.
Right. I want to, before we go back to phone calls, we do have many of them. You also said something that I think is very important here. We have people saying, and I've heard from these people, and we've heard them on television, too, saying that Trayvon Martin was convicted, not George Zimmerman was acquitted because there was not sufficient proof, but that Trayvon Martin was convicted of a crime. How in the world can we say that?
Woo, Kathleen. You've been reading my mind, haven't you?
I've been reading your thoughts. Yes.
Well, you've been reading my yes. Well, and I'm just something's going up on the All In with Chris Hayes web page that I've written about this. I believe it's going up today. So I encourage all your viewers to go look at it. This is a really disturbing storyline that we're hearing interpreting this case, and it's wrong in two ways. So first of all, just from a legal standpoint, there are two ways from a legal standpoint that this is just wrong. I mean, obviously, one, Trayvon Martin was not being was not on trial. Only George Zimmerman was on trial. Secondly, an acquittal, it's misunderstanding what an acquittal is. An acquittal in a case like this means that the prosecution did not meet its burden of proving that George Zimmerman wasn't reasonably in fear of losing his life. Now, reasonableness in this case doesn't mean that George Zimmerman was correct in being in fear of his life. It just means he wasn't crazy for being in fear of his life. What the defense attorneys are out there saying now is that it was a travesty for him to be in charge in the first place, that Trayvon Martin was this violent, crazy kid that just wailed on him. And remember that we don't have Trayvon Martin's version of the story because he was killed.
Right.
So all we know for sure, and we know from juror B37, that three jurors wanted to convict him of something. That means that even if they didn't feel they could, even if they didn't feel they had enough evidence to convict him, that they felt that there was something unreasonable about what he did. That cannot translate. His acquittal cannot translate into a conviction of Trayvon Martin, who was not on trial for being a Skittles-toting 17-year-old boy.
Right. And then you have all these people, these wild-eyed ideas. Well, you know, this is how bad he was, you know, painting this 17-year-old as some kind of terrible thug who eventually was going to be a criminal.
Yes. Well, then this goes to my point about implicit bias. This reinforces implicit bias. It's one of the reasons why we have to fight against these kinds of storylines, because essentially what people, and not everyone says this, I mean, we should acknowledge there's a huge outpouring from people of all races trying to understand this and who are certainly saying and talking about this in a very responsible way. So I do not want to say where I think there's a lot of good conversation happening out there. But for those who are saying he was a criminal, he was convicted, oh, look, the worst, and I think his attorney said this on Sean Hannity's show, the one of the worst things that the judge did was kept out the evidence, his cell phone call, right? Mm-hmm. Remember his text messages on his cell phone, as if they were going to prove he was a thug.
Right.
And I don't know, for anybody who has kids, you know, I look at, and I live in a very racially diverse neighborhood, and economically diverse as well. And you could grab any number of those kids' cell phones, whether they're white, whether they're Latino, whether they're South Asian, you're going to see a whole lot of stuff that maybe as a parent we wish we didn't see on their text messages. But that's not the same thing as then turning that into a narrative that they are all thugs. And so this is an example, I think, of where the story that we start to weave about what actually happened is now, if we move to a narrative of this is a thug who was beating George Zimmerman within an inch of his life,
right.
That's actually just reinforcing the stereotypes that we should be afraid of
black children.
Absolutely.
Rich in Green Bay. Hi, Rich.
Hey, thank you very much. What a wonderful show. I'm white. My wife is white. We adopted an African-American child at birth, and now he's 18 years old. And if you put a hoodie on him, that's Trayvon Martin. Mm-hmm. I was also a cop for 32 years in both New York and in Wisconsin. And every time that boy walks out the door, I'm scared as hell. Racial profiling in law enforcement, it's walking black or driving black through a white neighborhood. I don't know how we're going to change this. I love shows like this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Rich.
Oh, I'm so appreciative of that call for so many reasons. I mean, I think it underscores the point that I'm trying to make, which is that we have a lot of good happening in this country, and I think that caller really evidenced that. So I really want to thank that caller for his service to the community as a police officer, as well as, you know, for his humanity. This is really important. We don't have to live this way. One of the things that I'm so hopeful about and encouraged by is that the research on subconscious bias, it shows us that we can undo it. If we have the will, we have to pay attention to it, we have to learn it, we have to know what academics know. I mean, this is where academics has got to come out of the ivory tower, and we're at the Center for Social Inclusion working very hard to make sure that happens. Because there's work, Dr. Phil Goff, who's at UCLA, is working with police chiefs in 26 different police jurisdictions who are deeply committed to trying to figure this out on the kinds of training that reduce profiling. And so we know that there's some things that are starting to work. We have to support them now because 26 police chiefs, we should have all police chiefs. But that's encouraging to me. It's also very encouraging that the research shows where we live together, work together, where we live in truly integrated communities, and know each other in non-competitive contexts, that we reduce implicit bias. So it's not that we have to have implicit bias. We have structured society to reinforce stereotypes.
Right.
If we live in segregated communities, right, if we don't understand, how we are actually all so similar and how we can recognize and see that similarity rather than seeing the difference, we can start to dismantle some of the stereotypes and the actions, the unconscious actions they can produce.
We have a long way to go to get there, don't we? Sometimes I think you would have thought by 2013 that a lot of this segregation in housing and schools, and it's no secret to you that I'm speaking to you from the most racially segregated metropolitan area in the whole country. It takes a lot to make it change, doesn't it?
It does, and I think one of the things that has been working against us is this narrative that's both exists in the law as well as in the public consciousness that somehow we've gotten past race. We have gotten past some significant bad actions that we have done in this country, and that's meaningful and important, and we celebrate those. We've made it illegal to discriminate intentionally. But what we have seen is both in our lawmaking, in our Supreme Court decisions, and in our public consciousness is the false belief that race is no longer relevant.
Right.
And that therefore, if people are living in segregated communities, it's because they're choosing segregated communities. Well, there's all kinds of evidence that, you know, people are either cannot afford to live. We have communities that refuse to allow affordable housing to be built in them to keep people of color out. We have examples of real estate brokers who are steering people of color out of white neighborhoods and steering white people out of neighborhoods where people of color live. So we have all kinds of things happening that are producing the segregation. Our public schools are more segregated because our housing is segregating, and we still assign students based on where they live.
Right.
So we certainly have to be willing to say that we as a country that is the most pluralistic in the world, I mean, we are probably one of the most racially diverse countries in the world, that has been experimenting probably the most successfully, I would argue, with democracy, but that we're still working on it.
Right.
We're still perfecting our union, and our challenge now is to recognize that our union is becoming more and more racially diverse, and that we are not necessarily paying attention to the way that race still matters, and we cannot buy into this line that it doesn't.
When you think about it, it's one of the darn best things about the country. We've always been, you know, give me your tired, your poor from all over the world. It's one of the things that's wonderful about this country, and it's so noticeable when you go most other places in the world. It isn't as diverse. It's a great thing.
Yes, it is a great thing. If we can embrace it as a great thing, and I think one of the things that the stereotyping does, and we've seen this in the immigration debate too, and we saw this in the healthcare reform debate, where there's really what I'll call and what social scientists call racial anxiety, which is that, you know, we're changing demographically so quickly, you know, and already half of all live births are to people who are not white. So 18-year-olds and under are already half people of color, and by 2042, there will be no one numerically dominant racial group, right? There will be no one majority. Even the whole language that we use around minorities, we will have to change. But that doesn't mean that we're actually collectively participating in our country's problem-solving and decision-making, and that we're collectively seeing ourselves as an us rather than a you or and them.
Yes, yes.
And I think this is one of the things that Trayvon Martin's tragic killing is doing, is it's at least helping call us to that conversation.
Teresa in Western Wisconsin, hello.
Hi. First start, I'm very sorry about what happened to Mr. Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin, but I am for Stand the Ground Law. I wish they had it here. We have been stolen from twice, and we even tried to catch up with the person who did it the one time. By the time the cops got there, it was too late. Number two, the media blew it all out of control. The picture they showed of Trayvon Martin was him as a 12-year-old. They did not show him as a tattooed 6'2", 175-pound man he was. Number three, he was kicked out of school that day for selling drugs and in possession of stolen goods and a screwdriver. And he was high on drugs at school. He was not an innocent, like they are trying to portray. And if you want, I have the whole thing on the Internet that I can forward to you.
Maya.
So a couple things, you know, my home has been broken into. So certainly, you know, when we're victims of crime, we are understandably wanting to protect ourselves. One of the things that we should know about Stand Your Ground laws is there's lots of research that shows that Stand Your Ground drives the number of homicides up in the 24 states that have Stand Your Ground laws. The other thing we should know about them, because that does not make us safer, that makes us more vulnerable to death. The other thing people should know is when we look at prosecutions that happen as a result of homicides, when white folks kill someone who is black, there's 34% are not convicted because of Stand Your Ground laws. The same is not true for blacks who shoot. So only 3% of blacks who assert Stand Your Ground laws are actually protected by Stand Your Ground laws. And that's the story, for example, of Marissa Alexander in Florida, black woman who shot her gun into the air,
yes,
hit no one, killed no one, asserted Stand Your Ground because she had a husband who she had a protective order against, and she is in prison for 20 years, despite Florida being a Stand Your Ground state. So I definitely relate to the caller's concern and frustration about crime. The question is, how do we make ourselves safe? Stand Your Ground laws make us more vulnerable. I mean, the other point is, and there's a lot of stuff out there on the Internet that's been vilifying Trayvon Martin, and we can get into a factual debate about what's right and what's wrong. There were many things that the caller said that I think are factually not accurate, although I totally acknowledge they're out there on the Internet. Not everything on the Internet is true. But what I will say is at the end of the day, the question is whether Trayvon Martin, unarmed, walking in his own neighborhood, returning from buying candy at the store, was a danger and should have been shot and killed from a man who admitted, frankly, that he was suspicious of Trayvon Martin, but had absolutely no information to suggest that Trayvon Martin was committing a crime. Because that is the black experience in the United States, is that we are feared based on our appearance, not based on our action.
Maya Wiley is our guest this hour, founder and president of the Center for Social Inclusion. She's a civil rights attorney, a policy advocate, and she has developed programs to transform, no small task, structural racism in the United States and in South Africa. 800-486-8655 is our number. Email, we have a couple of those coming in. We'll go to those when we return, and that's talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655. Here's an email that's come in, Maya, from Kathy in La Crosse. I read that the Stand Your Ground law prohibits someone from starting an incident and then claiming self-defense. Is this true? Was this information brought out in the trial or in jury instructions?
Well, the Stand Your Ground was not at issue in the George Zimmerman trial because he didn't assert Stand Your Ground. That was something that obviously he had the right to do and was considering but chose not to and just used a traditional self-defense. So Stand Your Ground, it is one of the things that was troubling about what juror B37 said on CNN, because the jurors talked about Stand Your Ground being relevant, except it wasn't in the case. But certainly Stand Your Ground is not supposed to be, at least in some of the I can't speak for the Stand Your Ground laws in every single state, because, of course, states can vary that legislation in various ways. But certainly Stand Your Ground isn't supposed to enable you to basically go and attack someone and then claim stand your ground as a defense.
Right.
So certainly it's not supposed to work that way, but I think that's my point about why we see differences in who's prosecuted despite asserting stand your ground and who is not. So my point about Marissa Alexander saying, stand your ground, I was in my home, I was protecting myself from a husband that beats me, mm-hmm. I have a protective order, I shot in the air. Sorry, you don't get the benefit of stand your ground.
Yeah, right. What do you think Eric Holder, the Attorney General, meant when he said we need to stand our ground?
Well, I think I shouldn't speak for Eric Holder, but what I heard in what he said was, one, we have to stand firm that justice matters. And that race matters, and that we have to make sure that we are acquitting ourselves and acquitting and actually following the law and protecting ourselves. And that certainly what that means is people who care about justice, we need to stand our ground on figuring out what we have to do to make the system a more just system.
Yeah. Lynette in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. You know, here's my thing. I have a couple of things. First thing is the caller who called and said he wasn't this innocent person. This goes back to good versus bad black person. You know what I mean? He could have just gotten out of jail that night. If he wasn't bothering anybody and walking down the street, you know, he still has a right to walk down the street. And as it relates to the juror, she said, well, I can't identify with Janelle, the witness, who gave very good testimony that someone ran up to Trayvon and something happened. Her ear witness testimony was very good, but the jury said, I couldn't identify her with her, and I didn't understand what she was saying. She just dismisses what she says.
Yeah,
Maya.
Oh, I think that's a very important point. When one of the things that happens in trials are like theater. I was a trial attorney for a number of years, and what good trial attorneys do is they to the extent they can, they put on good theater because they want a jury to believe their version of the story, and so they try to make it real. But you have the witnesses you have, and when we are different, given who I am and who my friends are and what my experiences were growing up, I see a Rachel Gentile probably very differently from someone who does not have my experiences in life and in the world. So I think this notion of who we relate to, there's a lot of subjectivity in trials. So we're talking about the Trayvon Martin case as if there's only objective, there's only fact. Well, a lot of what juries are asked to do, including in this case, is say, which witnesses do you believe and which witnesses do you not believe? And we are all more likely to be able to believe people we relate to who look like us, who remind us of people we know and trust and respect. And if we look at the public attack on Rachel Gentile, you know, a lot of it was because she did not reflect that.
Thanks, Lynette. Wayne and Holman, hi.
Hey, it's good to talk to a Brewer fan. We're still out there, dear.
I know we are, Wayne. There aren't many these days.
You have a great guest, and she seems fairly objective, from my opinion. What I'm concerned about and want to hear is discussions from the African-American leadership, political leaders, on black-on-black crime, which seems to take a backstage to all of this. This is depressing to me because I feel for the African community. They're not being fairly represented from my Catholic conservative position. And I'm wondering why it takes this kind of an issue for us to discuss, as an example, only 29% of African-American women who give birth are married. That's a discussion we need to have from the black community. And I'm speaking to Barack Obama and Holder. And God love the African-Americans. They help make this great nation. But we seem to be so racially motivated now. It's like, where do we go?
Maya.
Well, the interesting points, and one thing that it's important to note is the black community has been having, including black leadership, been having conversations about the black family for decades. So, and how to create and support strong black families. And one of the things that we should note about why so many black leaders are saying that the justice system is not a just system does relate to what it does to the family. I mean, we actually see people who are black self-report, 2.6 million people who are black self-report using drugs. Literally five times as many people who are white report using drugs. Yet, black people are 10 times more likely to go to prison on a drug offense. Now, that's about policing communities that are black and not policing all communities equally. And what that does to the black family is that one out of three black men are in the criminal justice system. So that actually does also have an impact on black families. I mean, I think it's also important to note that Jamel Bowie actually writes with the Atlantic Monthly, wrote a great piece called Why Black on Black Crime is a Dangerous Idea. And basically what he's saying is that, you know, if you look at actual crime rates, are because of media portrayals, we think that most people who commit crime are black because that's what we see in the media. And that's what reinforces our implicit bias, right, of being afraid
yes.
if we see someone black. And secondly, that blacks are constantly killing other black folk. And it's a really important piece because he's actually pulling out the data that shows that actually there's a lot of violence and crime that is perpetrated against black people that are not perpetrated by black people. And so our conceptions of what's even happening in black communities is often driven by misinformation, and that misinformation, or it's accurate, but we're attributing one particular instance to a whole group of people. And it creates this subconscious, our brains create shortcuts, and it says, oh, black, male, handcuffed, Latino, undocumented immigrant, Muslim, terrorist,
right?
I mean, so all kinds of associations, it's not just against black people, that we make subconsciously. So I think all of the caller's issues that are raised are really important issues. We have to understand what's actually happening to understand where the problems lay.
Yeah, which sounds like we'll track down that author. Tim, we only have about 30 seconds. Can you put it in 30? Tim from Milwaukee?
Oh, hey, how you doing, ma'am? I just wanted to say that I'm absolutely astounded. You're the first person I've heard talk about the psychology aspect of stereotyping and how it's a passive brain activity that people don't understand. I grew up off of center in Milwaukee as a white kid. So I have kind of lived the other side of that argument with my father telling me how to deal with other people who may want to cause me harm. I've spent the last 10 years in the Army. Mm-hmm. I work with kids in inner city Savannah, in between deployments. And I think a lot of it has to do with psychology and just cultural violence, both in inner city black communities and how that's represented to people through the mainstream media.
Thank you, Tim, very much for your call. What a wonderful hour. Thank you so much, Maya, for being with us.
Thank you. And a big thank you to your audience. I appreciated all the good questions.
They're good, aren't they? Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley.